bottle. So when I got home, I was like, oh my God, I found three more bottles of Michter's.
You poor bastard.
I know. That's what all I can say on that now.
I have never heard. There's the world's smallest violin, and it's playing for you right now.
It's tiny, I know. But yeah, someone's got to throw this trash away. not the booze. I mean, like, I the boxes
say,
that they came in.
I was gonna
no, the
say,
booze is fantastic. The booze is the last, is the furthest thing from trash.
I was going to say, Aaron, you shouldn't say that about yourself. You're a great guy.
let's not get too carried away.
All right, you're a guy.
I'm a guy. Do I deserve these four bottles of Michter's? I don't know.
No.
Better people than me have drank these, for sure. I mean,
Aaron is a very good friend of yours. I'll tell you, you don't.
Did you know that over $5 trillion exchanges hands on a daily basis? That's an average of over $220 billion an hour. Now, how does this much money move every single day, and why does it move the way it does? Here on Drunkenomics, two bartenders who also happen to be students at the University of Nebraska Graduate School of Business are going to sit down and drink to the global economy and try and translate it into English. So sit back, relax, pour yourself a stiff one, and have a drink with us to the comedy that is the global economy.
Hey guys, and welcome back to another presentation of Drunkenomics.
Presentation. Nice.
So the presentation, it's the drinking podcast with the economics problem.
That is us.
So
that is Drunkenomics.
Your welcoming back host am, as always, a host of dubious graciousness. We will see where we go today. But James Goldwater, and then right alongside my main man, and usually
I have more grace than you, but who knows? I mean, I just received four bottles of Michter's, so in all different kinds of Michter's, and by the way, they're all excellent. So if you never had Michter's before, go ahead and check it out. But my name is Aaron. I think I have more grace than you this week because the VIX is at an all-time low. At least it feels like an all-time low because all-time started about a year ago.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. Now, I think that it's just occurred to me that I really do have my graciousness has an inverse relationship to the VIX.
Yeah, so when the VIX is above 30, it's like, oh,
yeah, cool,
James, he's being so gracious. Wow.
Of course it is.
And it's like now, like the last like five trading sessions, it's been below 20. I mean, I don't know. I haven't kept track. I just don't remember.
I mean, it closed under 18 today, so.
Well, it wasn't it under 18 for a while today?
But
the weird thing was, going into our presentation that is, you know, the drinking podcast with an economics problem, the jobs report.
Oh, out of control good.
Yeah, the jobs report was fantastic on Thursday.
It's going into Friday trading.
Yeah, but guess what? There wasn't a trading session on Friday because of Good Friday.
Mm-hmm. So it was like a weekend jobs report.
Yeah, so
what was it? 945, 960,000?
I don't remember, but it looked really, I mean, they blew past expectations.
Oh, yeah, by a huge margin.
Yeah, which I'm really happy about, but it's like, okay, so here we go.
916,000, the estimated 675. So
oh my gosh.
250,000 roughly.
Yeah.
A quarter million above par. So that's great.
Yeah, but so like a payroll report came out at the same time too, and that didn't look as good.
Well,
it didn't look nearly as good. I mean, first of all, it missed expectations.
Well, we've talked historically about the difference between employment, unemployment, and
right.
How well people are doing, right? Because
for
all I know, that's one really busy guy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's what I'm saying. It's like, you know, last week you said the markets are always looking for a reason to go up, which they found a reason to go up last week because of a great jobs report.
Huge.
Despite payroll numbers.
It is good news.
Yeah, it's good news. It's a sign that the economy is coming back to life,
mm-hmm.
if you will. And markets, they reacted very sensitively.
Yeah.
I mean, it was very sensitive.
What'll be very interesting for me is, and I imagine this will, if once COVID's firmly in the rear view
mm-hmm.
and the economy kind of gets going again, there are also some very interesting labor things I've seen, specifically this Easter weekend, that I was like, ooh, that's a very interesting thing. I wonder what's about to happen. I guess we're going to see the results of the Amazon and Alabama union vote, which will be very interesting.
Yeah.
And that kind of touches
huge.
On-
That's going to be huge news.
Is, and that's going to touch on like what I saw on Easter Sunday, which was to say that like Target was closed. A lot of other businesses were closed, just fully mm-hmm. closed. And it's a real swing back kind of towards labor, getting time off.
Right.
That we haven't seen historically, you know, when it's like, oh, it's Thanksgiving. We're just not closing. Why mm-hmm. are corporations doing it? I can't tell you. Probably because they thought they'd lose more money having people in the store than people were coming to spend money on.
Well,
Easter,
exactly.
But
it's not just like having people in the store, but it's like taking deliveries.
Oh, yeah.
Keeping the lights on, all that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Storage costs.
Mm-hmm. I'm willing to bet it's they saw the costs were higher than the potential revenues. So they decided, we'll just not incur the variable of those costs, or most of those variable costs.
Yeah, there you go. What's the uncertainty, right? Like we talked about last week with the swaps, you know, it's the uncertainty that swaps exist to take away that certainty, or take away the uncertainty, if you will.
But they also create whole new uncertainty themselves.
Yes, as you can see.
As we saw.
No, but I think that's what happened on Easter. And this is, you know, we're recording the day after Easter, in case you guys are wondering. Mm-hmm.
What I was getting to before I got sidetracked by myself, you know, what are you going to do?
As you do.
But it'll be very interesting because right now we're looking at like these amazing jobs reports and we see the market go up and we're seeing less great payroll numbers. So, I mean, that's a good reason to maybe tamp the brakes. But if we ignore it, we can ignore it. We'll be okay, I think. But eventually what'll happen is we'll start seeing like these incredible jobs reports continue to flow. And I think that's when you start to see the market start to go down again. And that's because what's going to happen is investors are going to suddenly start realizing, oh, it's an employees market right now. Well, it's going to cost more money to hire people.
Yeah.
It's going to cost more to get that competitive guy in to expand my business.
Do you really think so?
Well, we've seen it in the past. We see it in the past when we see certain markets are deluged by people. So if we look at like certain focuses in law, there's too many lawyers in certain areas.
Okay.
So it's always going to be an employer's market there. But then we get to other places and that's where you're going to start to see the employees market, the labor market start to be able to demand higher wages.
But what I'm trying to say is, to me, there's so much labor out there because COVID not only took away a bunch of jobs, but they realigned jobs. They made the economy more remote and they made things more digital.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not digital anymore,
certain jobs can't be. I mean, don't get me wrong, guys. I'd be more than happy to invite you all into a Zoom meeting where I sit in a room, polish a glass, and listen to you guys talk about issues and tell you how to make your drink. But you're not going to pay me to do that as a bartender.
They're going
to
tip you. Yeah,
you're going to want me in the lounge making the drink for you and listening to you do that while you watch TV over my shoulder.
Totally.
So, you know, I get it. What I meant when I said, like, when you start to see these jobs reports keep stacking up like that, right now, the reason markets shoot up when they see that is they see people are going back to work, which means they have more, which means they have money, which means they're going to spend money, which means that we're looking at the economic cycle. It's like, okay, there's more revenue.
Right.
Coming. So there's more potential revenues. There's more demand coming.
Yeah. But it's a natural cycle of like, you know what? You're meeting your future expectations. You're actually meeting
it's them, not, it's right? not just, oh, things could have been worse. It's like, hey, we cleared the hurdle.
Exactly. And then not to mention, you're paying back your debt. Mm-hmm. That's huge.
But, what I mean is eventually, if you see these job reports continue, what it means, or when you start to see the job reports fault, but you see like then the payroll numbers start to get really good for like labor. Again, payroll reports are great for labor, not so great for the guys paying it. So it's this very interesting tug of war, you know, push and pull.
Yeah.
But eventually you see a point where it's like, well, job reports have been shooting through the roof for a while. It's about to get expensive to hire.
Yeah. People. And my thing is with inflation, because like everybody's talking about inflationary concerns and we're seeing a ton of inflation in the markets. We're seeing a ton of inflation in any sort of asset, whether it's real estate, gold, Bitcoin, whatever it is.
Well, they're all, I can't speak for, Bitcoin certainly flirts with it, but I can tell you as a whole, assets are at record levels.
Yeah.
Real estate, all
everything,
of
right? Yeah. So,
and still the Fed is pumping money into it. It's just like, why? I'm concerned.
So,
why?
So when I start talking about inflationary concerns, I feel like with the greatest hedge against inflation being as expensive as it is, which is the stock market. In case you guys didn't know, I've said this in previous episodes, but the greatest hedge against inflation is the stock market. With that being as expensive as it is, you know, trading at 22 times PE or whatever, it's like the only thing to me that would validate and solidify actual inflation, and this is going to sound terrible, but I'm going to say it anyways. What would solidify inflation is if wages do go up. Sounds terrible when I said it.
If wages actually went up, you might have grounds.
I know.
For someone to sit there and be like, oh, inflation's about to be a concern. But here's the thing. Prices have gone up.
But not to buy a t-shirt is still $15. I mean, that's not changing.
Sure. So what I mean with like, when I look at like prices have gone up and it's like, and I say like, we need to rethink wages. Kind of my main view on a lot of it is whoever is serving you your combo meal at McDonald's, at Wendy's, it costs them more than 1 hour's labor to buy that combo meal. So that's a minimum wage kind of like argument. So it's like, so salaries need to go up? Yeah. Because I remember when I was a kid, and it was like, oh, prices essentially for fast food has doubled and wages haven't kept up. So it's one of those things where it's like, is there inflation? Yeah. Is it being driven by increased salaries? No.
I know it's not, but I'm just saying.
I mean, like, we've consistently said that if you keep raising prices and cutting salaries, or even just if you don't let salaries grow, but you let prices rise, eventually as a business, that's a bad idea, because when your employees can't afford to buy from you, you have a problem.
Exactly. But I'm just saying, like, as soon as wage growth goes up, mm-hmm. that really validates, like, okay, now that you're getting paid more, you have more to pay for a t-shirt, things. To pay for things, right? But the prices of meat have gone up. There's no doubt about that. The price of oil has gone up, but it's also because there's a small supply for oil because there's a small demand for oil.
Well, there's also less like economic need for it right now. So it's like right. When we say like, so, oh, we're transitioning to different fuel sources, it's like, well, my response to that is, are they providing the same amount of electricity at maybe a better or more sustainable rate? My answer is yeah. If the answer is yeah, my response is fine.
That's what I'm saying, is like oil is becoming less elastic. Wait, no, sorry.
It's more elastic.
Way off. It's becoming more elastic. Sorry.
I thought you said less inelastic. And I was like, I mean, that's one way to say
that's what I thought I said too, but it turns out I didn't say that. So
that's what I was like about the intro economics classes when you're trying, when like they're trying to trick kids into thinking about the exam or quiz question.
No,
it's like
it
becomes more inelastic, less inelastic, more elastic. You know, that's one of the things you're just kind of like, why are you using a contrapositive?
No, that's
which is just more inelastic, but it's still there.
No,
like,
that sounds
oh,
like, no, that's full disclosure. That sounds like the Series 63.
Well, I know, but it's like, it's any exam that's trying to make you think about every single question instead of asking you if you understand.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a lot of problems with how exams are conducted, and that's, and on true, false banks like that. It's,
well, let's leave that where it is. And let's go into supply side, demand side economics. But before we unfold that flag, I just want to wrap up that whole subject of the whole inflationary concern, the wage growth and all that kind of stuff. I'm sorry if I sound kind of harsh, but to me, that's just the way I rationalize economics. And if you disagree with me, let me know, because I want to know why I'm wrong. But anyways, we had some good interactions in our Discord. We had a ton of questions.
We did. It was a great time.
Yes, that I found out way later than I should have. But I was drinking by myself on like Thursday or Friday night. I can't remember what night it was. And I saw all these questions and I just responded to all of them.
And I'll be honest, I think you nailed it on. Definitely when you were covering for me on, I say covering for me because I hadn't logged in a week, and that's on me. That's my fault, guys.
You're so bad with computers.
Okay, so what happened is Lincoln got warm. And so I put on my...
Gotta go out and hit some golf balls.
I had to go outside and just prove a point because it hasn't been warm for a while and it's been...
I went out and hit some golf balls the other day and it was depressing.
So to Joni, who asked the about my socialism for the rich, brutal capitalism for the poor, Aaron, your answer that you put in the response before I answered, you nailed it.
I don't know what I said.
Yeah. No, well, you nailed it. So it doesn't matter. You nailed it. You tapped right into to my soul and you nailed it.
Well, we had a question about the efficient market theory, which that was from a couple of episodes ago when we said the efficient market theory is literally just a theory. The random walk theory seems like it's not a theory anymore, because the random walk theory, in case you guys are wondering, is literally like if you put a blindfold on a guy that can see, right? A guy with vision, the guy that's not used to being blind. If you put a blindfold on that guy and you put him in an empty room and you, and somewhere randomly in the room, you said like, find this gold brick, and you had this guy walk around the room until he found the gold brick, that's what the chart pattern would look like for the S&P. Because he's randomly walking. I feel like it's become less of a theory. Granted, there's still a lot of trends that hold true for a lot of individual securities, but I feel like the S&P 500, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what people are seeing in these valuations. To me, they're way off, but people are willing to pay for it, so who cares?
Well, so to me, the efficient market hypothesis, I think it's silly. So the premise that I've always understood, it just means the market is absolutely right and that everything is correctly valued. Yeah. So there's no way.
Well,
it's, yeah, I know. It's a big if. It just says that they are. It's a big R.
Big R.
It says that that's all it is. And it says that there's no way to, so through market timing or other things, there's no way to buy something at a discount or overpay for anything. Everything's right. The market is absolutely correct at all times.
And investors know when to leave and investors know when to stay in and even load on their position, right?
So the only reason I look at the efficient market hypothesis and I go, no, is because to me, that is such a, the argument is so behavioral economics that it's just like, you can't possibly make a good point.
Well, my thing is, it kind of goes off of another question I was asking.
Because we know that in economics, we have to assume that everyone's a rational actor. But the thing is...
Which is not true. Okay, well...
Which we know not to be true.
Right. But that's Richard Thaler's theory of behavioral economics, which is everybody acts rationally. Mm-hmm. Everybody is going to invest in an asset that they think is actually going to go up. And the reason why they think it's going to go up is because it's undervalued. So if you see something that's undervalued... you pull your investments in that asset. But I think, you know, now, it's kind of divorced itself from buying low, selling high to buying high, selling higher, right?
I guess the other real problems with the efficient market theory are the fact that the market is obviously inherently inefficient in that there's a lack of information coming from the companies to the investors, and there's also totally. A finite amount of capital going to being able to buy things. So it's one of those things where it's like you're trying to make an inefficient thing efficient, which is not inherently a bad idea.
No, it's not.
But at the same time, to just say like, oh, that price is accurate because everyone is making good choices, it's like, really?
Well, this is my other theory too, is like, so we had another guy on our Discord asking about Robinhood and their IPO and all that kind of stuff. Like I said, I have my views about Robinhood, but for the most part, I think it's fantastic that they introduce this commission-free mm-hmm. access to the markets. But at the same time, I think what sucks about Robinhood is that they introduce this commission-free. The same exact thing that makes them amazing is what makes them terrible, right? Because what they're doing is it's like Facebook. If you're not the customer, you're the product. If you're trading for free on Robinhood and you're like, I've never paid Robinhood any money, it's like, well, if you're not the customer, you're the product, right? So what they're doing is they're selling your trade information, your order information, all that kind of stuff. The traders on Robinhood, I feel like, influence the bid-ask spread for so many securities. It's not even funny. And it's because Robinhood routes this information. You put in a limit order for a certain price. You know, if enough people do it on the Robinhood platform, that's going to pull the bid price or the ask price in a certain direction. At least I think, well, I have no idea.
If enough people are doing it, it's definitely going to affect one or the other. It's enough people doing both things.
Yeah, because if there's like, you know, let's just say there's 100,000 market orders and let's just say there's 2 million limit orders. Like, in my opinion, that's got to pull whichever side of the trade it's on. It's going to pull in that direction. It's going to pull it towards wherever the limit price is set. So because they introduced this commission-free type of trading, it's kind of made the market detach itself from efficient market hypothesis, because now there's too many irrational actors. Now there's too many people in the markets that don't know how to evaluate stocks. And is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? I don't know. If the Wall Streeters and the super wealthy people are taking advantage
of these trends,
and they have more access to information, so it's tough for the little guy to win. And that to me is a little bit dangerous. I feel like if commissions came back on, if you had to pay $7 for a trade, I feel like maybe that'll make you look more into things.
Well, but at the same time, my issue with Robinhood, and it's an issue their IPO isn't going to solve, is that if we look at how Robinhood makes their money, it's clearly not commission.
No.
It's clearly not, they're not their own broker. Well, they have to use a prime. So it's order flows for information. Well,
yes. Let me say this. Robinhood, they're beholden not to their clients.
No.
They're beholden to the people that actually buy the information from them. Who buys information from Robinhood?
Prime broker.
Yeah. It's friends like Citadel.
Well, they're prime brokers as well, because the prime broker will say, okay, route your trades through me. And so then a broker could sit there and they actually have talked historically about high frequency trading and the amount of technology it takes to get there. So they can see, if they can see 2 seconds ahead that there's a huge sell order.
But that's it's not one huge sell order. It's multiple sell orders.
They see a total of 2 million shares in the same firm being sold coming down the pipe, and they have a position in that.
Done.
They can sell it.
Ahead of that order being placed. Ahead of that curve.
So they can sell at a better price. Now, at the same time, if they see huge numbers of buy orders coming down the line, well, they can buy at a much lower ask.
Right.
And then sell at a higher bid. They can turn around and be
exactly. So
when you looked and you bought, it was $12.50. But by the time your orders were processed, it was $12.75.
Right, exactly.
They get to buy at one, sell at the other, pocket the difference.
Right.
And the only reason the price went up is because they were the middleman sitting there going, oh, you want to buy 10?
Well,
I'm buying these 10. I'm selling these 10 to you. And because I just bought those 10, the price went up. So this is the current price.
Yeah. So that's my thing about Robinhood.
Yeah. You know. And so when they IPO, so they've what? They filed for a.
It was a private
IPO. My response is their business model is not going to change once they IPO. It's just that they'll be publicly owned as well. And so my view, and this is not investment advice, is I would never put a penny into it because I don't see how they're going to make money other than bilking their clients.
Right. And you could be extremely wrong because I feel like it's
going to go through the roof.
I feel like their stock is actually going to do pretty well for a while. But at the same time, they're facing enough backlash where I feel like if you're just betting on their volatility, I think you're going to make money. But I'm not going to bet on their volatility. I'm not saying you should, because I don't think you should.
I'm not going to say you should or shouldn't. I'm just going to say I won't.
Yeah.
The other thing is they're also still facing that lawsuit. They're facing a lawsuit at the same time they're facing backlash. At the same time they're facing securities investigations. At the same time they're trying to IPO. I've heard worse ideas. I'm struggling to think of some right now, but I've heard worse ideas.
So like that's what I'm saying. Like worse ideas than like betting on their volatility.
Well, I just meant worse ideas than like what Robinhood is coming up with right now. So it's like, yep.
Yeah. So, but yeah, enough about that. Let's go into supply side and demand side. This Michter's just hitting me pretty good already. It's not a good sign. So let's go into supply side and demand side economics, because this is like my favorite subject of all time. And I know it's like one of yours.
Two schools of economic thought.
Yep.
The two schools of Keynesian economic thought. We used to just be able to call that economic thought, but it's okay. We've had 100 years.
As soon as this guy named John Maynard Keynes decided to show up on the scene and, you know, name everything after himself, it's like,
I don't think he was quite that arrogant, but arrogant.
I'm willing to bet
he had an assistant and he looked at his assistant and said, "Oh, what should we name this?" And they're like, "Well, you're on my tenure board, aren't you?" And he goes, "Mm-hmm. How about we call it Keynesian theory?" You just made tenure. Well done.
Yeah. Also, I'm all out of whiskey. Give me some more whiskey. Is Victor's around yet? Shameless plug again.
Yeah.
Anyways. So, yeah. I mean, like, you and I are on the same side of the fence on this.
Because we're both demand side guys, aren't we?
Yeah. For the most part.
There are certain points where I look at supply side and I go, supply side economics makes a certain kind of sense for very specific goods.
To me, it's more so services, right? Where it's like, I mean, let's just say you move into a neighborhood and then like within a 5-mile radius of this neighborhood, there's like 100 barbershops. It's like, well, you're never going to pay more than $10 for your haircut, which wouldn't that be nice?
So increasing the supply is not necessarily going to create more jobs.
Right.
Now 1,000 barbers.
But it's also like increasing the supply side isn't going to make more people want to get a haircut more frequently.
Correct. Right? It's not going. So there's a finite, obviously they both have limits. I think that for me, the thing is that with supply side, it simply doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And we have seen we finally have that study out of the London School of Economics that has looked at the last 100 years of development, and their conclusion is,
Max, what's going on, man?
But their conclusion is, and they have their study, they have their research, and it just says every time there's a cut in taxes on businesses or on the extremely wealthy, what we have not seen is an increase, is the promised increase in job growth or wages. It just doesn't happen. So that tells me that supply side doesn't work. So another thing you may have heard supply side economics called is trickle down economics.
Hold on. Let's back up here. I agree with you. Like, first of all, you and I disagree on how we view Ronald Reagan, but we agree on how we view trickle down economics.
Yeah. There's no fight for me there.
Okay, cool. Awesome. So my thing is, like, I do think the wealthy, or not the wealthy, but business owners, innovators, I think they do create jobs.
Yes.
Google has created a ton of jobs.
But that's not what I was saying. What I was saying is
I know, but I just wanted to just cover that barrier and say, like, hey, you know, Amazon has created a ton of jobs. Google, JP Morgan, you know, all these guys have created these jobs.
Businesses create jobs and then firms create jobs. Yes, I agree.
Okay.
But I think this is where we agree on the demand side of things. It's the reason they create more jobs or expand their businesses is because they have more consumers looking for their product.
Exactly.
This is the demand side. So there is a demand for whatever it is that they're providing. And as long as that demand isn't being met yet, they're still demanding excess of the supply they can provide.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to expand their businesses because there's still demand there.
Right.
Let's kind of go back to the beginning. So there's demand side economics and supply side economics. They both start in very different points. They both then go the same thing. So the second step of both of them is essentially they hire and expand their businesses. And the third step is the people who have been hired spend money in the economy as us.
And then they grow their businesses, or grow their local economy, et cetera.
They agree on steps two and three. They disagree on what the start is.
Right.
And the supply side economics argument is the start is if you cut taxes, people will build. And now that may have been true historically, but I don't think it's true now. And the demand side of the argument, the demand side says businesses that are selling goods and more goods and services hire more people. So what it says is, well, my thing is I can give huge tax breaks to a business that has no revenue, and I swear they're not going to hire anyone.
Right. So I think this is kind of where you and I differ a little bit in this area, and not by very much, but my thing is, like, I don't think tax cuts are necessarily a bad thing. I do think when you increase corporate taxes, just for the big companies, you make them increase their wages and say, hey, employees, you guys pay the taxes.
I agree with you.
Because we don't want to pay the taxes, right? Or they increase more money in R&D, which consequently increases wages, or expand.
Someone else has to hire more people, whatever it is.
Or they build
it drives
a new office,
money into the economy.
Right, exactly. Or they build a new office and all of a sudden, like, all right, now there's a construction crew in this new city that have work now. So I do agree with you in that sense, where higher corporate taxes for big companies, I do think it gets them to do that. But my thing is, like, higher corporate taxes for smaller companies, I think it weighs them down.
I agree.
If there was a tax bracket for corporate taxes,
I would be all for that too.
That'd be amazing. I don't like just corporate taxes in general, just flat out 28%.
I would agree.
28% is not a bad, like, I don't think that's a, I think it's a great tax rate for corporations. But I just, to me, I think it weighs down on small businesses.
Goldman
Sachs, pay 28%.
Yeah, under the bus.
Freaking,
I don't think 28% is enough for the really big guys. Let's put it this way. The fact that Zoom, Amazon, a lot of these guys don't pay a penny in federal taxes, that's a problem for me. It's a very serious problem.
I understand. Hold on. I understand where you're coming from, but they still pay. I mean, Amazon paid what, $12 billion in taxes? Just taxes in general.
I don't know.
Federal taxes.
Sure.
Not federal taxes, but taxes in general.
I won't concede that's correct, but I'll accept it. I'll accept the number pending for future verification.
In 2017, they paid about $12 billion in taxes.
Okay.
Whether that's from sales tax, from
employee tax. So they paid some taxes, and that's good. They should.
No, you should. Should.
100%. The issue then becomes is, are they taking tax credits? Are they receiving refunds from the federal government? Because
let me back up. So their net tax expenditure, I think, was about $8 billion. So
yeah.
They paid about 12 and they received about $4 billion or something. I can't remember what it was. There's something along those lines.
That's a problem to me.
Well, this is 2017 numbers, right?
Well,
so
I don't know what it's like now.
But you got to say, they still paid about $8 billion in taxes, which is a lot. I mean, that's a lot more than most people. I'm not saying it's good. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not saying it's right. I'm not saying it's wrong.
For me, what I'm saying is, I mean, my issue is you're going to see a lot is with every single one of these companies, you see rent seeking. You see them asking for a loophole for this.
Right.
Or asking for a loophole for that. Or asking for just a lower tax rate in general. Now, what have we seen corporations do when they get lower tax rates, when they get tax holidays on overseas profits? What do they do?
First off, they
don't bring very much back. And when they do bring it back, do they build more offices, hire more people, raise salaries?
Yeah.
No, they pay down debt and they drive up share price.
Right, yeah.
That's
the thing. Like, everybody knows, whenever tax cuts occur, share buybacks happen.
Debt retirement, share buybacks.
And why wouldn't you?
Well, no, I certainly understand it. Now, see, that's why it's interesting. You saw what Janet Yellen said today, right?
Yeah, with the whole IMF thing?
No. Well, maybe it's part of that. But I saw where she...
The global minimum tax rate?
Global minimum corporate tax rate.
Janet Yellen, I love you, but
She's not wrong.
No, I can't agree with you on that one.
Why?
I can't agree with you on that
one. In the 50 United States, we have a minimum corporate tax rate. It's the one set by the federal government.
I know, but I'm saying, like, countries like Ireland, if you want to, like, have a corporate tax rate of 10%, why not? I don't know what the rate is over there, but
we've both argued in the past about, like, velocity of money and, like, the supply of money, right? If we assume that at some point you stop printing more money and you know that 10% of the cash a year, and I'm using extreme values here. If 10% of the cash a year is going to Bermuda out of the United States, it's being put overseas, it's being offshored. The money goes out. Well, the first year you lose 10, the second year you lose 9, next year you lose 8.8. But it doesn't take long before most of the money is sitting offshore overseas.
Right.
It's not in the economy from which it's being extracted.
Well, okay. So
what I would say is the way to do it is I think it's actually even easier than that, is what you do is you say, so go to any company and say, what was your global profit, period, from everywhere? And they go, $100 billion. And you go, very good work. 30% of your sales were in the United States. We're taxing 30% of your global profits at the end of the day. You're paying taxes in the U.S. on that. And so then they could say, but it's in Ireland. It's in Bermuda. It's in the Bahamas. It's here. I don't care. You can't move where your customers were. Your customers were in the United States. you know, tax in the United States.
Yeah, so
no reason Bermuda has $30 billion in profit, because I can tell you,
right,
Bermuda hasn't bought that much stuff.
Exactly. So I'm all for being taxed where the transaction occurs. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying, like,
I think that's what we're going to have to go to, is to a transaction-based tax system.
Which I'm 100% all for.
I'm surprised by that, just because I didn't think you would be, but...
Really?
Good.
Why did you not think I would be?
That's not fair. It's not that I didn't think you would be. I think as practical guys, we're both like, fuck it. I just think at the same time, you're like, yeah, but the system lets me be in Ireland, so fuck it. I mean, I'm trying to make money.
No, I'd be all for that. But this brings me to like the Joe Biden infrastructure bill, which I'm like, dude, first of all, this is a $2.3 trillion bill. Okay. I have no idea what your reaction is on the Biden infrastructure bill. I think it sucks. Just go ahead and say it.
I think it sucks too. I think we think it sucks for different reasons.
No, I don't think we do. I think we think it sucks for the same exact reason. I think you think it sucks less than I think it sucks.
Okay.
But I also think we think it sucks for the same exact reason, which is the government wastes so much money.
Okay. Yeah, of course.
So well, the government and the next entity that wastes more money than the government are movie studios. So,
well, they have tax reasons for that, which
quick. A movie studio would be like, how much does it cost to rent this space out? $15,000? Done. Here. I don't want to argue. Let's just do it, right? So the government is not like that, where it's just like, how much does it cost? And then like the company, like, you know, Lockheed and Martin, would just be like, I don't know, $200,000. And the government's like, done, deal, let's go.
And then Lockheed shows up 3 years later and goes, I know we said 200, but it's actually going to be 600,000 now. And the government's just going to write the check. I absolutely agree.
That's why the government sucks. That's why they suck at spending money.
They're great at spending money.
It depends how you want to look at it.
They're great at it.
For sure. They're fantastic at it, but not in terms of the way you and
I look at it. They're not so great at coming back and being like, no, I'm holding you to your bid or something. They're not responsible when they spend money.
That's what I mean. They're not responsible. So the U.S. government doesn't have the balls to go up to Boeing and be like, look, we agreed that this project was going to be done for $40 million. We don't care how much it costs you. You guys should have saved more money. You guys should have been leaner.
You guys should have been. We came to you. You quoted us 40. Now you're coming in for 55. No, you said 40. Deliver, we're getting our money.
We're going to go to someone else. So that's the reason why I think the government sucks, and that's the reason why I think this $2 trillion stimulus.
This is the rent seeking from those companies, which then go,
I know,
we employ so many people, and if you don't honor, if you don't just keep giving us money, we're going to, our share price, which is because we're publicly traded companies, by the by, is going to go down, and then
let it go down,
dude.
Screw it.
Preach.
Lockheed Martin, Bill.
Preach.
If they can't honor the government contract, it's like
you can honor a contract.
I guess it's legally binding. But so what I mean is, like, I don't know if they have to restructure things, right? And I don't know exactly how
that works. That's a talk. If you have legitimate reasons that you have to restructure, there's a process for that. It's almost always in the contract. But when you sit here and say like, oh, I know we quoted you, we'd be able to deliver this for $50 billion or for $50 million, $50 million. Mm-hmm. And then they show up, they go, actually cost us $88 million. So you owe us that extra $38 million. If they haven't delivered yet, my response is, no, I don't. Not until you deliver.
Well,
and even then, you quoted me blank, and either you did it in good, and if you did it in bad faith, which is to say you quoted me that number knowing it wasn't correct. And most of these guys do. They quote knowing it's not correct, knowing that they can just run, they can run over budget and they'll get their money. They do that. They don't care.
I mean, but it's not even just like, you can look at like the major list of companies, right? Like the Boeings and Lockheed Martins, and I don't know who else.
SpaceX.
Glock, SpaceX, right? I mean, but like if you look at like the military, Glock, Smith & Wesson, all those companies, right? Those guys overcharge the government like crazy for everything, which like, well, if I was a business, would too, but it's just,
You've seen the movie War Dogs, right?
Oh God, yeah, I love that movie. With Miles Teller and Bradley Cooper.
All you need to know is that the U.S. government, yes, fantastic film.
Mm-hmm.
All you need to know is that's a true story.
Exactly.
The U.S., the Department of Defense got in bed with two guys in their 20s hanging out in Miami to supply weapons and other equipment to the Iraqi army, and we're paying them out the nose.
Yeah, exactly. So like the government is not responsible for spending the money. So like when you look at the Biden infrastructure plan, my thing is, you think it should be like a $500 billion bill, right? And I do agree, roads, bridges, and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, no, I actually think they should be spending more money. I just think they should be spending it more efficiently.
The government?
Yeah, the more efficiently part is where we both agree it's just not going to happen.
Well, okay, well, no. So let's back up here. Because I don't think to fix what they're trying to fix, I don't think it's going to cost $2.3 trillion.
I think it's going to cost more. And I don't think that because the government's inefficient. I think that because there are so many bridges, just bridges, and then we'll add dams to the list, but bridges and dams that need work. And my concern is they're going to get there to do the work and realize, oh, it's too late for that. This needs to be replaced.
Do you have any idea how much you can do with $20 billion?
It's an inconceivably high amount of money.
Much money.
But the sheer number of bridges.
And the amount of time it could buy. The amount of time $20 billion can buy is a lot of time.
I'm aware,
too.
But bridges and dams. I'm telling you. And on top of that, not just bridges and dams.
I hear you.
Bridges and dams everywhere simultaneously. So you can't do all of it simultaneously.
But that's not their plan.
It's over the next 5 years.
There you go. Okay. So.
But even then, that's not enough time. Not to really do it. Because let's look at.
I'm not with you on this one, man. Hang on.
Let me just look up one thing.
Even if you included like the whole cybersecurity, the internet thing, right? Which that's a big part of Joe Biden's thing. Which, like, if you look at the bill, like, the vast majority of the bill is not going towards that. I mean, it's literally going towards subsidies for, like, major corporations.
Okay. Yes, you're absolutely right. Throw them under the bus. Dude. They got a free ride last year when they got free money and all the rest of the buying out from the Fed and everything else. And I absolutely can't stand it.
No, I wouldn't give them a single penny.
No.
Dude, no. You know my stance in politics, so it's not a surprise to you. I hate this. I hate this infrastructure bill.
It needs to be done. So what's happening is, and I hate the subsidy side of things. I absolutely hate the subsidy side of things.
I
love the money going to local governments.
Okay.
But here's why it's happening. I can tell you why it's happening before I can tell you anything else.
Sure.
In 2009, we passed the stimulus to get out of the 2008 hole.
Right.
And
we passed that in 2008. It hit the market.
Well, it hit in 2009. But what happened right after that is that was supposed to be the first part of many. And what happened is the Republicans. So here's where I'm going to have to throw politics in.
I hate where this is going.
Republicans in 2010 woke up and said, oh my God, the deficit. Oh my God, the debt, which they only do when they're not in charge. Because when they're in charge, they spend like drunk sailors.
No, but I don't think it's the Republicans. I think it's everybody.
No, I think the Republicans. No. What I mean is the Republicans don't want to spend money when they're not in power. And so they curtail spending.
Right, so they blame it on the Democrats. Right. I understand what you're saying.
You're absolutely right. Whenever you're in power, you absolutely spend like an idiot. Everyone, both sides do it. That's not what I'm arguing. The part I'm arguing is that the Republicans were able to stop that from happening between 2010 and 2020 and on. And the general consensus right now in economic circles is that delayed the actual recovery by 4 years.
From
2012.
Because in 2012, there's another stimulus package, not a stimulus package. There's another
mini
TARP kind of program for the car companies. Yeah.
So
right?
what we see is that Republicans didn't want to spend then, and it slowed down the recovery. Markets rebounded just fine.
Yeah, of course
they
did.
The economy did not.
Of course they did.
So the economy didn't recover for 4 more years. Now, they were playing politics.
Of course.
And that's all it is. Both sides do it. I'm not saying it's just them. It's just they seem to be better at it because they actually seem to accomplish their stated political objective, if not their real objective.
No, I think both sides are terrible at playing politics. I'm not terrible. But they're,
no,
they're
the Republicans
great.
At least work together to do things.
They don't. No.
But
I disagree.
I used to be a little more convicted about that, but now I'm not. So the thing is, right, what it is now is they've learned the lesson from 2008, 2009. We didn't spend enough money then, and it hurt the economy. It hurt the recovery, the actual economic recovery. They're not going to make that same mistake again. They're going to spend too much money, and it's going to create a whole different set of issues.
Right.
I don't deny it. There's always problems.
Them overspending, it's got to go in the right hands.
Yes.
They spent $2 trillion. Like, if not a single dollar of that went to anybody making over 50 grand, that would be extremely
beneficial. Well, I'd also see, and I'd be more than happy for it to even go to people making 100 grand or 80 grand or whatever it is.
Lower, sure.
Everyone lower, definitely. Anyone up to that point, I'm still fine with if they're in the right field.
Right, exactly.
So if you've got a construction foreman who's working overtime now, of course. If he's working 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, right? He should be making more money.
Let me ask you a question. I mean, we're talking about $4 trillion here. So you want to talk about supply side and demand side economics?
Yeah, fine. But let's, I agree with you. I absolutely agree that spending needs to be reined in.
In truth,
what I actually think is spending needs to be reined in. We're going to disagree on where that spending needs to come from.
Totally.
But we also need to raise taxes.
I understand that.
How does James do that? He raises corporate tax rates by quite a bit, and he creates a new tax rate off the top for corporations. And then he creates three new tax brackets on personal income. And he says, fine, go live in those. And they get punitive after a while.
No, exactly. I don't deny it. So I think as far as like the tax structure goes, like I think you and I actually have a pretty similar agenda. Wow, agenda is a terrible word nowadays, but I think you and I have a similar viewpoint on that. But to me, it's just like, all right, so we do need to increase tax receipts. I'm 100% with you on that one.
Hell, I'd be fine with just closing loopholes right now. Start there, see what that does.
So let's do that. Why increase the rates when you're just going to increase loopholes?
Well, I mean, like I said, that was me kind of an excuse. I have three things. For me on taxes, there's three things.
Of course.
I close the loopholes.
I think that's all that needs to be done, but...
Well, okay, so second, I think you'll agree with this one too. I would take the cap off the Social Security. So if you make more than $125,000, for every dollar you make over $125,000 every year, you don't pay a penny in Social Security.
Done. Yeah, exactly. Social Security is the biggest shortfall. It's literally the biggest shortfall in tax structure right now. It's terrible.
Let's close the loopholes so people have to start paying instead of being able to hide their money. Let's take the cap off that to actually fund that better. And if that doesn't work, we'll reassess what we have to do with Social Security. And if closing loopholes doesn't work, then we'll reassess what we have to do about balancing our budget.
Okay.
Now, obviously, it's all predicated with, we do cut spending on programs that are shown to not work. We are more responsible with our government contracts because when you're Boeing and you've said it'll cost you $40 million per launch to put your satellites into space, the second they come, they send me a receipt or they send me a bill for $42 million for that. And there's no like clause that says with fuel, blah, 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 blah. But the contracts will be written with the understanding that if you go over budget, that's on you. Take the loss. Bid more accurately next time. Maybe I wouldn't have gone with Boeing. Maybe I'll go with Lockheed. So obviously we're going to get spending under control. We're not going to overspend on our contracts. My third thing would be I'd add two or three more brackets off the top of personal income. I'd also make every single bracket that currently exists bigger.
Well, this is the thing. I want to reward spending.
Absolutely. Oh, I'll let you. And if you're now, with certain exceptions, I'm not going to let you donate art.
Well, so I want to go back to like supply side and demand side economics, where it's like the argument of supply and demand, which is literally the first thing that you learn in economics.
Yes, it is. So based on the old like graph.
The supply side and demand side of economics, what does that affect? It's price.
Well, so there's
it's price of a certain good.
They affect price and then the quantity service. Either supplied or demanded.
Right, exactly. So if supply goes up, obviously price goes down. If demand goes up, price goes up. That's the relationship between supply and demand.
If they both go up, you might see an increase in quantity, but no change in price. If they both go down, that's when it becomes harder. We could say if both supply and demand decrease, the quantity demanded will decrease or the quantity supplied will decrease.
Right.
But we can't speak to price. And if they both go the same direction, we can speak to quantity, not price. If they both go opposite directions, we can speak to price, but not quantity.
Right. So real quick, I just want to touch up on the subject. I think a bigger driving force behind supply side and demand side economics is the demand side.
Absolutely. For me, it's really simple. If you don't have customers, it doesn't matter what you're charging. If no one wants your product.
You charge $0, right.
There was
a time when nobody thought computers was actually, like, I mean, everybody was like, it's going to be like a new fad. It's going to be like, Apple's going to be like Motley Crue.
Well,
and they're going to gain popularity and they're going to lose popularity just as fast. So, I mean, sorry, no offense if you're a Motley Crue fan. But I'm just saying, like, my best analogy for supply and demand side economics is like NFTs. Who knows anything about NFTs? I don't know anything about
NFTs. If I was capable of creating 10 tomorrow, would anyone want them? I have no idea. And so I don't want to make them.
Exactly.
But if I had 15 people come up to me tomorrow on the street and they said, James, I will give you $5 million for each NFT you create. They have a demand. My supply will follow.
Yeah.
I will supply.
Yeah. So NFTs are getting created left and right because there was an NFT that was sold for $69 million. So to me, you know, there was the demand for NFT. There's the demand for that kind of asset. There's the demand for Bitcoin. Even Bitcoin. I think Bitcoin is super demand driven.
No, but all I'm going to say is like, you know, we've tried to talk supply and demand. Now, obviously, at some point, there's a finite supply, but there's also a finite demand, right? Because there's only a finite amount of income that you can buy with. So there's finite demand. There's only finite supply because there's only so many seats in Memorial Stadium. So there's finite supply. There's finite demand in the long run. But in the short run, if there's enough demand, supply will meet it. But if I oversupply a market, that's not going to drive up demand.
No, exactly. And that's the thing with the Memorial Stadium was like the demand for seats has gone up. What do? They expanded the stadium. They didn't expand the stadium because...
Because they needed more demand. There was demand, so they expanded the stadium.
There were 100,000 people requesting a seat in Memorial Stadium. So they're like, all right, you know what?
80,000 accommodate
that.
Fine.
We're going to add 30,000 more seats and, you know, build it. What is that? The East Stadium side? I don't even know.
Is it the East?
It's been a while since I was an athlete there. Okay. All right. I graduated in 2016. I stopped playing golf there in 2016. So it's been a long time since I've been in the stadium. So I don't know.
The amount that Google knows about me, it told me I haven't been into Memorial Stadium in 2 years.
Wow.
It's 2019.
Yeah,
I think what it really means is 2020 because I was definitely still going into there in 2020.
I'm not going to lie. That sounds like supply side economics. But, you know, we'll save that argument for later.
Sure.
Anyways, let's wrap up. I hope you guys are drinking some Michter's. If you guys have never had Michter's, drink some. I just really like this product.
Yeah, it's a good one.
And hopefully one day we do get sponsored by them.
That'd be nice.
With that said, merch, shop.spreadshirt.com/droconomics. You can buy a shirt and look as cool as James.
It's true. So. I, too, have some pretty sweet new merch. You look as cool as Flynn if you've got a dog that you want to have a swag like that.
Well,
boy.
Hold on. Probably not as cool as Flynn. I mean, Flynn is pretty freaking cool.
They'll look just as cool.
It's tough.
It just won't be maybe as good looking.
Okay. I can love with you there. I mean, you might have a dog that's very good looking as well.
Hopefully your dog's smarter. Let's just go with that.
Your dog is definitely smarter. Maybe your dog is better looking than Flynn, too. I don't know. I mean,
you know what?
Let us know.
You know what? You're gonna have to put some Drokenomics merch on that dog and send us a picture because otherwise, you know, Pixar didn't have to.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
So with that said, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Drokenomical, UNKUMICL.
In all of those places, you can find the link to our Discord where you can join the rest of the Econaholics to
all of us.
Talk to us, interact with us frequently.
Ask us questions.
Join the questions for the host chat. Just hang out in the general. Meet other Econaholics.
Stuff.
Send us some awesome pictures of you guys just hanging out in the world, filling and killing your drinks.
Yeah. From there... last but not least, Patreon, patreon.com/Drokenomics, DRUKOMICS. If you're feeling generous for some reason, you can donate to us there and stock our liquor cabinets.
Help us keep the lights on, help us keep the glasses clean and the ice clear.
Yeah, clear ice ain't cheap. You wouldn't know
hard.
How expensive that is. But I appreciate all the support you guys do, and thanks for listening. But with that said, I don't know if I said chestnut checkers, but
you did.
I haven't. Let's say chestnut checkers. Why be playing checkers when everybody else is playing chess?
I don't know. Chinese checkers, maybe.
Well,
if there's enough people.
It's not strategic.
It is when there's 6 people playing.
Well, I mean, are they filling and killing?
I mean, okay, fine. Fine.
See? There we go. So, with that said, I guess there's only one thing left to say.
Ooh. Wait, hang on.
What?
Stay drunkenomical.
Cheers, my friend.
A Huda Media Production.